Have you ever stopped to think about the sheer chaos of sound that hits our ears every single second? I mean, right now there's the hum of the equipment, the distant city traffic, my voice, your breathing. Cool. How does the brain take that wall of noise and turn it into something meaningful?
It's a question that honestly keeps me up at night. For me, it always comes back to music. I can listen to an orchestra with 90 different instruments playing, and my brain just sorts it. It picks out the melody in the violins, the rhythm in the percussion, the harmony. It's not just hearing. It's constructing an entire emotional landscape from vibrations in the air. Mm-hmm. It's magic.
Exactly. And for me, it's language. The difference between the raw sound of a word and its meaning. The subtle shift in tone that can turn a simple phrase into a joke or a warning or an insult. As writer, that's my entire world. How we shape sound to tell stories, and it all happens in this one incredible, mysterious part of the brain.
The brain's silent composure.
That's it. Today, we are pulling back the curtain on the auditory cortex. We're not just talking about the mechanics of hearing. We're going on a journey into the very place where sound becomes perception, where noise becomes music, and where vibrations in the air become in it. Well, everything.
And we're going to explore some mind-bending questions. How does this composer learn? What happens when it's damaged? And how is modern science revealing its deepest secrets?
This is going to be a fascinating one. So to get into those secrets, we first have to admit something. For about a century, our map of this territory was, well, it was kind of wrong, or at least dramatically oversimplified. We had this classic model, the Verne-Gershwin model, that basically drew a simple line from a hearing area to a speaking area.
Right, the one that's in every psychology textbook. Wernicke's area for comprehension, Broca's area for production, a simple, neat little loop.
A neat little loop that, it turns out, couldn't explain what scientists were actually seeing. It was only with the advent of things like fMRI, where we can watch the brain work in real time, that the door was blown wide open. We realize it wasn't one loop. It's more like
two superhighways, both starting in the auditory cortex but heading in completely different directions.
Okay, I like that. Two highways. So where are they going?
Well, they're built to answer two fundamentally different questions. One stream, the auditory ventral stream, flows forward toward the front of the temporal lobe. Its job is to answer the question, what?
What am I hearing?
Exactly. What is this sound? Is it speech? Is it music? Is it a threat? This is the recognition pathway. The other one, the dorsal stream, goes up over the top toward the parietal lobe, and its job is to answer the question, where? Or maybe even how?
Let's stick with the what pathway for a second, because that feels enormous. That's the composer you were talking about, the part that separates the violins from the percussion.
It is. And the detail we can now see is just staggering. Researchers have found that within this one stream, some neurons are more selective for simple syllables, while others, further down the line, fire up for longer words or whole melodies. It's a hierarchy of recognition.
So it's like an assembly line for meaning. The raw sound comes in one end, and it gets progressively more complex and identifiable as it moves along this ventral stream.
That's a perfect way to put it. And they've done these incredible studies where they record directly from the cortex. They found a patch of brain in this pathway that becomes more active when a person listens to their native language compared to a foreign one they don't understand.
Oh, wow. So it's not just processing sound, it's processing familiarity. It's cross-referencing a lifetime of experience in a split second.
And that brings up the next stop on the highway, the memory bank. This ventral stream doesn't just identify sounds of the moment, it connects to what's called the semantic lexicon. Think of it as the brain's massive multimedia dictionary, where the sound of the word dog is linked to the image of a dog, the feeling of its fur, the sound of its bark.
The concept of a dog.
The entire concept. Which is why, when this pathway is damaged, the results are so strange. Patients might hear a sound perfectly clearly, but have no recognition of what it is. An auditory agnosia. Or they might make semantic errors, like you said earlier, calling a fork a spoon, because the conceptual links in that dictionary have been severed. And to me, the most fascinating part is that this whole recognition system, this entire dictionary, isn't just crammed into the left hemisphere like the old model suggested. It's bilateral. So it's happening on both sides of the brain.
So the idea of a logical left brain and a creative right brain is also too simple?
Far too simple. Studies on patients with disconnected hemispheres have shown that the right hemisphere has a vocabulary that almost matches the left. Unilateral damage, or damage to just one side, rarely wipes out comprehension entirely. You need to damage both highways on both sides to truly silence the composer.
It's a distributed system. It has redundancy built in. That's just beautiful design. It's not a single point of failure. It's a network, a resilient bilateral network for understanding the world through sound.
And that resilience, that redundancy, is just his, it's a masterclass in engineering. But it also makes me think about the other side of the coin. We've talked a lot about this incredible what? Pathway, the ventral stream that builds our dictionary of the world. But what about that other superhighway, the one that goes up and over the top?
The dorsal stream. The where or how pathway. See, this is where it gets personal for me. It's one thing to recognize a C-sharp minor chord. It's another thing entirely to tell your fingers how to form that chord on a guitar neck.
So it's the action pathway. It's not about recognition, it's about reproduction.
It's the bridge from sound perception to sound production. This dorsal stream connects the auditory cortex to the parts of the brain that control the mouth, the larynx, the hands.
Mm-hmm.
It's the pathway that lets you hear a word and then say it back, or hear melody and then hum it.
So, wait a minute. Is this why someone can have perfect hearing, understand every word you say to them, but be completely unable to repeat a simple sentence back to you?
That's exactly it. It's a condition called conduction aphasia. The what pathway is working just fine, they comprehend. But the connection, the road from the listening centers to the speaking centers, is, it's washed out. The information can't make the journey.
That is profoundly unsettling. To have the thought, to understand the sound, but to have the mechanism for output be disconnected. It's like the telex machine receives the message perfectly, but the wire to the printer is cut.
That's a great analogy. And it's not just for language. Think about trying to learn a foreign accent. You can hear the sound perfectly in your head. Your ventral stream has identified it.
But making your mouth produce that exact same sound, that's your dorsal stream trying to build a brand new roadmap for your tongue and lips. It takes practice.
Oh, that makes so much sense. It's the physical, the motor mapping of sound. It explains why I can listen to an audiobook in a perfect British accent for 10 hours, understand every nuance, but the second I try to imitate it, I sound like a bad parody.
You're paving the road in real time, and your brain is going, whoa, 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 this is not the usual route to making a vowel sound. It has to overcome decades of muscle memory. It's pure dorsal stream workout.
So these two streams, they're in constant communication, right? They can't operate in a vacuum. You need the what to inform the how.
They have to be. Think about a conversation. I say a sentence. Your ventral stream figures out what the words mean. Instantly, your dorsal stream is using that information to formulate a response, mapping the concepts back into motor commands for your own speech. It's this incredibly fast, seamless dance between the two.
A dance. I like that. And when the music stops for one of the dancers, the whole performance falls apart. It's not just two separate systems. It's a partnership.
A partnership that defines so much of our interaction with the world. And it raises another question for me. If this system is so complex and interconnected, what happens when the raw information it's receiving is compromised? What happens to the composer when the instruments themselves start to go out of tune?
That is the million-dollar question, isn't it? Because it's not a hypothetical. For millions of people, the instruments are out of tune. We're talking about hearing loss. What science is showing us is that the brain... It doesn't just register the silence, it actively tries to fill it in.
Oh, like phantom limb syndrome, but for sound?
In a way, yes. When the auditory cortex stops receiving input from certain frequencies, the neurons assigned to those frequencies don't just go quiet, they get restless. They start to get re-recruited by neighboring frequencies. The brain map literally rewires itself.
Mm-hmm. So the composer is faced with a shrinking orchestra, and instead of just writing for fewer instruments, it tells the violas to start playing the cello parts? That sounds chaotic.
It can be. This reorganization is thought to be one of the underlying causes of tinnitus, that ringing in the ears. The brain is creating sound where there is none, trying to compensate for the missing input. It's a ghost in the machine, born from the brain's own incredible, sometimes misguided, adaptability.
Wow. So even in its attempt to heal and adapt, it can create a whole new problem. It just underscores how delicate this whole partnership is, the whole conversation today.
Mm.
It feels like we've gone from a simple line drawing in a textbook to this hitch, this living, breathing, constantly changing ecosystem.
That's the perfect way to describe it. We started with that simple loop, Wernicke-Broca, and now we have these two massive parallel superhighways, one for identifying what a sound is, the other for figuring out how to respond to it. And they're not just on one side of the brain, they're bilateral, redundant, resilient.
And they're plastic, they can change. That, for me, is the most staggering takeaway. This isn't a fixed piece of hardware. It's a system that is shaped by every language we learn, every song we hear, and even by the sounds we lose.
It leaves me with a real sense of, well, of humility, I suppose. We're mapping this incredible territory, and the more we map, the more we realize the borders are constantly shifting. The complexity is just breathtaking. It makes you appreciate every single conversation, every piece of music, as the miracle it is.
For me, it's less about the map and more about the music itself. It brings it all back to that initial feeling, listening to an orchestra and just understanding. Knowing that it's not magic, but this intricate, beautiful dance between what I'm hearing and how I'm making sense of it, it doesn't diminish the wonder. If anything, it makes it even more profound.
A beautiful thought to end on. It truly has been a journey into the heart of how we experience the world. Thank you, as always, for the incredible conversation.
And thank you to everyone listening. We hope this gave you a new appreciation for that silent composer working away inside your own head. Until next time, listen closely.